I read an article from the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. It talked about spirituality and religion, and it said that half of the people in the UK and the United Kingdom are spiritual, but they don't associate themselves with any sort of religion. And they interviewed about 10 people, and they got snippets from their interviews. And so these are some of the words that they describe their spirituality as. So they said love, compassion, reflection, relationship with other people, a sense of gratitude, happiness, having peace in their lives. And it's interesting that one person mentioned God out of all those people they interviewed, but none of them mentioned Jesus Christ. And I think spirituality is great. I think we're spiritual beings. But if you define your own spirituality, your own sense of who you are as a spiritual being, what happens is you create this bubble that's just your world, nobody else's world. And that's where you want to stay. You don't want to be in conflict with anyone. You don't want to be stressed about anything. You just want to be at peace with yourself and with other people. I think Christianity, however, tells us there's a bigger world out there, that there's a world that's created by God who's bigger than us, a love that we can receive from Jesus Christ that's bigger than we can even begin to imagine. So what does it mean for you as followers of Jesus to know that you're a Christian, and a Christian that lives in this world that God has created? I think sometimes it's easy to forget or get distracted or lose focus on what our Christianity really means. Sometimes it's easy to sort of make up our own definitions of what being a Christian is. Sometimes it's easy to think of ourselves in comparison to other people and see how we stack up with them. And I think in a lot of different ways, we can sort of be self-defining about our Christianity and just believe it's about ourselves. We've been going through most of the last sections of the book of John and talking about Jesus' road of glory to the cross. And so we're in the last chapter of the book of John. And what does this closing chapter, what does it tell us about Jesus and our faith? Well, previously in the last week, we've been talking about the resurrection of Jesus and how Jesus encountered people when he came back to life. The first person was Mary Magdalene alone. She encountered him by herself at the tomb. And then Jesus encountered the disciples without Thomas in a room. And then 8 days later, Jesus encountered Thomas with the other disciples in a room also. So this last portion details his appearance to the disciples. It's his third appearance to the disciples, his fourth appearance that we know of in the book of John. And so this is what John has described here in John chapter 21, verse 1. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. So we don't know how much time elapsed from his last appearing with Thomas in the room to this moment that we have in chapter 21. But it tells us in verse 2, Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. And Simon said to them, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we'll go with you. And they went out, got into a boat, but that night they caught nothing. So, and you know, some people say, they kind of try to get into the disciples' heads, and they say, well, the reason they go fishing is because they're still sort of shell-shocked. They're confused about this whole Jesus was dead, now he's alive, and how am I supposed to process this? So we'll go fishing. Some people say they just want to run back to their old lives. There's too much danger in following Jesus, so let's go fishing. Some people say, well, they're impatient. They should be waiting for Jesus. Jesus came to them after he was resurrected from the tomb, and then 8 days later with Thomas, and now they're just impatient. So they went fishing. But I think the lesson here is when you're waiting and you don't know what to do next, just do the next thing. Just do the next thing. So I'm guessing that disciples were devoted enough, where they prayed and said, Jesus, we don't understand. God, you know, show us the way. Give us an explanation. Come back again. And he just did not. So fishing just seemed like a good idea. They just did the next thing that they would normally do. And so for us, sometimes it's just really hard to wait, right? You're in a situation that's stressful, that's confusing, it's confounding, and it's hard just to wait. Sometimes waiting can be stressful. So doing nothing seems like the right thing to do, but sometimes it doesn't always give you the clarity that you want. So do the next thing. What would you normally do? And so these men went fishing. And as it turns out, fishing is exactly what Jesus wants them to do. As they did the next thing, Jesus meets them in verse 4. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" And they answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast a net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it. And now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. So again, as day was breaking, they said they were fishing at night. Jesus gives them instructions on how to catch a load of fish. And so verse 7 tells us, that disciple whom Jesus loved, this is the author of this book, John, who always talks about himself in third person, the disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garments, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. So Peter hears what John said, it's Jesus, and he pulls on his outer garments, jumps in the water, swims for shore as fast as he can. The other guys in the boats are saying, "Thanks a lot, Peter," because they have to drag the boats in with all these fish. In verse 9, when they got to land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have caught." So Simon went aboard and hauled the net. Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. So Jesus says, "Bring the fish to me. Bring the fish to me." And John tells us that specifically, these are large fish and 153 of them. So there had been a lot of papers written on why is it 153 fish? Why does John specifically mention 153 fish? And there's been a lot of speculation about this. Some people say these are the 153 fish are the known species of fish in the world at that time. So this represents like missions work, you know, like trying to reach out to all sorts of people. Some people believe it's a combination of different numbers. And I'm not good at math, but their math looks good to me. They come out to 153 at the end. But in reality, there's probably no biblical, religious, greater spiritual connection from this number 153. In verse 12, it tells us that Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. And Jesus came and took bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So let's think about this for a second. So these are men, mostly fishermen, maybe not all fishermen, but mostly fishermen who've been fishing all night without any success. And Jesus calls to them from shore and says, "Throw your nets out on the right side, and then you'll be able to catch fish." And then the disciples, John first, realizes Jesus. Now, is that the point of this story here? Is it just a simple realization? Oh, it's Jesus. We've been waiting for Jesus. He hasn't come by, so let's bring our boats to shore. Let's try to connect this. I think it's very specific how John has described this portion of the story. There was a point earlier when Jesus was teaching and preaching where he called certain men to be with him, to be his, what we call the 12 disciples, his closest followers who would carry out his mission. And we can pick up the story in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 5, verse 3. And Jesus was there talking to people, and getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, Jesus asked him to put out a little from land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." So here's the story. Jesus is interacting with these fishermen. Right? They've been out there all night trying to catch fish. They didn't catch a single fish, just like in John chapter 21. Jesus says, "Put down your nets," again, just like in John chapter 21. And in Luke chapter 5, verse 6, "And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boats, 'Come and help them.' And when they come, and when they came and filled both the boats, so that they began to sink." There was that many fish. But their nets and their boats did not break or sink, just like in John chapter 21. In verse 8 of Luke chapter 5, "But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, 'Depart from me, for I am a sinful man.' For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so also were James and John, son of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, 'Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men.'" So Peter falls at the feet of Jesus. He goes to Jesus. He's the first one that interacts with Jesus, just like in John chapter 21. So I think John's trying to connect these two stories here from Luke chapter 5 and John chapter 21. And in Luke chapter 5, there's fishermen on the lake. They've been fishing all night long. They haven't caught a single fish. They have no success. Jesus gives them instructions to do it one more time, and the load almost overloads their nets and boats. Jesus calls them to something greater than catching fish. He says, "You're going to be catching men from now on. Yes, it's great to catch fish. You need it for your livelihood. But your job from now on is to catch men for the sake of the gospel." John chapter 21, fishermen on the lake. They've been fishing all night. No success. Not a single fish. Jesus calls out from shore and instructs them, "Throw your nets down one more time." And they catch an overload of fish. And I think possibly what Jesus is doing here is reminding them in John chapter 21 of their calling in Luke chapter 5. It's the same circumstances. John is showing us that the disciples have come basically full circle again. They first committed their lives to Jesus, Jesus told them, "You're going to catch men instead of fish," and now Jesus wants to remind them of that. All the stuff that has transpired in between Jesus' teaching, his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion, his death, his resurrection, it's all maybe muddled their thinking and confused them, but Jesus tells them, "You're going to do it again," and reminds them again. The additional similarity that we have in this chapter is from John chapter 18, verse 17, when Jesus was arrested and Peter's there trying to listen in, trying to figure out what's going on, and this is his first denial. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You're not one of these man's disciples, are you?" And Peter said, "I am not." Right? This begins the first of his three disciples. And what happens is he's there and he's accused two more times. But in verse 18 of John chapter 18, it tells us, "Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself." And then what we read in chapter 21, verse 9, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid on it and bread. Now why does John tell us it was a charcoal fire, not a wood fire, not a gas fire, right? Not a rubbish fire? There's only two places in the Bible where this Greek word for charcoal is used. It's anthrakia, where we get our word anthracite, which is a form of coal. It only appears in these two places. So Peter, in his first denial, is warming himself over a charcoal fire, and he denies Jesus three times. And then in John chapter 1, he warms himself over the charcoal fire again. The first time he did it in denial and in failure of Jesus. The second time he does it in the restoration process that Jesus is going to put him through, through this threefold interrogation. And that begins this conversation that he has with Peter in John chapter 21, verse 15. Jesus says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And Peter said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. Verse 16, he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. Verse 17, Jesus said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he had said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Now, again, there's a lot of debate about our English word that we have here for love. A couple of Greek words, agape, phileo, love. One sort of means this unconditional, highly committed love. In other words, more of a brotherly love. And people have tried to dissect these three statements that Jesus makes, do you love me? And they're trying to break it apart and figure out what John and Jesus' intention is. But most people actually conclude that there's no strong nuance there that tells us Jesus meant one type of love versus a different type of love. So what can we say? We can say that Jesus asked Peter three times, do you love me? And that mirrors Peter's own denials previously, right? I don't know Jesus, I don't know Jesus, I don't know Jesus. I love you, Jesus, I love you, Jesus, I love you, Jesus. Now, maybe Jesus is saying to Peter, hey, you denied me before, but do you love me more than you love yourself? You see, when Peter boasted about what he was going to do for Jesus, he basically said, I will never leave you. I will never deny you. I'll always be there. If everyone falls away from me, I'll always be there. I. It was all about himself, how committed he was going to be, how dedicated he was going to be, how he was going to do more than anyone else. It all became about Peter himself. And Jesus asked him a very pointed question. Do you love me? Do you love me? And maybe they're within earshot of everyone else. That as they're talking, everyone else is sort of listening in and waiting for what Peter will say. So Jesus tells them, feed my sheep, tend to my sheep, feed my lambs. If you love Jesus, stop being self-centered. Stop making it all about yourself and start loving people. So Jesus connects, hey, do you love me? Yes, I do. Then do this for other people. Do you love me? Yes, I do. Then do this for other people. He says it three times. And I think Jesus is trying to drive the point home. If you say that you love me and you're committed to loving me, then what you will do is take care of other people. You will love other people as I commanded. John tells us that Peter's life will end in the pursuit of telling people about Jesus in verse 18. It says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after this, he said to him, follow me. So the tradition is that Peter did not feel honorable enough to be crucified like Jesus. He has to be crucified upside down on a cross. And so there's some words here that talk about being stretched out, being led by other people. But this final dialogue between Peter and Jesus is an invitation to really show us what it means to love Jesus. If you say that you love Jesus, what does that mean? And when I reflect upon this, I just think about all the number of times where I've denied Jesus in some way, shape, or form. And I can sort of feel the weight of Peter's sorrow and grieving also. But then I just remember that God's grace and mercy is greater than how I feel about my failures. It's God doesn't want to leave us there. He always wants us to have a way out. And I want you to notice when Jesus says, do you love me? And Peter says, yes, I love you. Then Jesus simply says, feed my sheep. Jesus does not say, oh, yeah, you said you love me, but, you know, you denied me three times over there, and, you know, you said you were going to, you're boastful, you're prideful. Jesus is not accusatory here, which I find really encouraging. Like, Jesus says, if you love me, just do what you're supposed to do. He doesn't go back around and try to make him feel worse than he already does. Right? And when we feel that way, that's sort of, if you're Asian, it's sort of a Confucius way of thinking, but it's also Satan speaking and saying, hey, you did really badly here, so are you worth it? You're not a good Christian, and you know you shouldn't even be a follower of Jesus. But that's not how Jesus interacts with Peter. He simply says, feed my sheep. But God isn't finished with Peter yet, because Peter can't let it go. He's just thinking, there might be someone who's closer than Jesus than himself. So he says in verse 20, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John, following them, the one who had also leaned back against him during supper and said, Lord, who is it going to betray you? Verse 21, and when Peter saw John, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? What about him? Like, isn't he the one that you love? Isn't he the one who had this great question, who's going to betray you? And Jesus responds in verse 22, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. And so the saying spread among the brothers that this disciple was not going to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? So people, so apparently there's this interpretation of what Jesus said, that John will not die, that he's going to somehow stay alive until Jesus comes again the second time. But we know that John is banished to an island to die there as punishment for crimes against the Roman government. But I think Jesus is using a hyperbole to communicate a greater point. And he's basically saying this to Peter. It's none of your business. It's none of your business. Just follow me. It sounds harsh, but consider what Jesus is saying to Peter and saying to us also, that we are liberated from the bondage of comparing ourselves to other people all the time. Now, I totally get this. You know, as a pastor, it's like conference after conference, book after book, seminar after seminar, tell me how I can be better in ministry. So, you know, whatever is in front of me on my computer or mail gets sent to me, and it's always subtly giving me this message that says, I'm not making it. My preaching could be better. Our missions could be better. Pastoral care could be better. Evangelism could be better. All things could be better because if I compare myself to someone else, they're better than I am. And here's what works. You know, you buy a book, go to a conference, do it this way, go to a seminar, on and on and on. You see, Peter's just been told that his death will be painful and full of suffering. And the first thought that comes to his mind was, what about John? If I have to suffer, will he have to suffer too? If my ministry ends like that, will his ministry end like that too? If I don't get to live a long life, does he get to live a long life forever? But, you know, I just think that's the way sinners are wired. Compare, compare, compare. That's the way you and I are wired, right? We always compare ourselves to other people. And that's what happened in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. Satan came up to them and said, you know, you could be just like God. You can be better than God. Compare, compare, compare. So we just have this inner craving to know how we stack up to other people. If we can just find someone that was less effective than we are, then we feel better about ourselves. So as whether it's you comparing yourself to another parent, to a coworker, to another married couple, to a classmate, to a brother, sister, or cousin, to another business, it's always about comparing yourself to another person. So what Jesus says is sort of freeing and refreshing. that Jesus will not judge me based upon my superiority or my inferiority compared to someone else. There's no preacher, no church, no ministry. Those are not the standards. It's what God has called me to do. And so Jesus has work for me to do, and he has work for you to do. Your calling is different than my calling. Your situation is different than my situation. But still, what is it that he wants you to do? You specifically. What anyone else is doing or accomplishing is none of your business. That's what Jesus is saying. What is that to you? Just follow Jesus. And John ends his letter with verses 24 and 25. This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know his testimony is true. Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them written, I suppose that the whole world itself could not contain the books that would be written. That's a funny line there. The whole world itself could not contain the books that would be written about the things that Jesus did. Now, although we think that the Bible is this thick book, it's massive, it's hard to understand, it's hard to read, but it only scratches the surface of what Jesus did upon the earth. Just imagine all the other teachings that we don't hear about. The miracles, the healings, the time of comfort, the encouragement that he gives, the times of rebuke. There's so much more than what we simply have in our own Bible. So let me bring it all the way back around. With whom do you identify? With whom do you identify? Do you identify with one, the disciples in the boat? Slide, please. So for the disciples in the boat, maybe it was one of those deja vu moments. You know, like you see something or you hear something, it's like, I've heard this before, I've seen this before. Now, psychologists have all sorts of answers for that, something about flashback in your memory or something. But with those times, maybe God's speaking to you and saying to you, yeah, you've been here before. He's trying to pull something out of your memory to say, remember your calling, right? And maybe it's the first time you became a Christian that it sparks one of those memories. Yeah, I remember when I became a Christian, this is what happened. Maybe it's a commitment at some conference you went to or some retreat you went to. Yeah, I went before them and I raised my hand and I said, I want to do this, I want to do that. Maybe it's a prayer you prayed to make a difference in your place of work or your community or your school. And Jesus is giving you that again. It's like, yeah, I've been here before. I've seen this before. And he's pulling things out of your memory so you will not forget your initial calling. Don't forget your initial calling. Or are you like Peter speaking with Jesus? Who do you love more? Do you love Jesus more or do you love yourself more? Does being a follower mean anything with people around you? So we always just want to think about our religion, our Christian life to be, oh, we just want to be righteous before God. But it's so much more than that. Right? So God said the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength and love people with that same love. And that's what Jesus is saying to Peter. That's what he's saying to us here also. Do you love me? Yes, you do. Then take care of people. Love people too. Do you identify with Peter? Or do you identify with Peter comparing himself with John? So with whom do you compare yourself to? And why? Remember, there's a God-given specific purpose for you, and you specifically, and it's yours, no one else's. And so it doesn't matter whether you're in a position of great influence or at the bottom of a totem pole, whether you're first in your class, you're an average student, whether you're parents of five children or one child, whether you're single or married, whether you're tall or short, it doesn't matter. God has given you a purpose and a calling. So stop comparing yourselves with others because it's a trap. It's a trap that Satan wants to keep you in because the longer he keeps you in that trap, the less you do for God's kingdom. So the story is not just about Peter's restoration back into a relationship with Jesus. If you think it's just about that, then you know maybe you missed the point of the story of this passage. But if you're a follower of Jesus, follow Jesus. Right? So do take those times to remember your first calling, how Jesus called you into a greater purpose of life. do love others. Because that's the greatest commandment, right? Love God, love others. And do live out your unique calling that God's called you to do. Because anybody else that's doing something else is none of your business, right? It's not worth your time to fret over. So as you leave this place, I really want you to think about, well, how does God want me to live my Christian life? Does he just want me to feel good and be at peace with people and be happy? Or does he want me to do something more? So some of you have been Christians for a long time, and you hark upon that. I became a Christian when I was about 8 years old. But I can't stay there. I have to grow and learn how to love people, and as in that process, stop comparing myself with other people along the way. And I think that's the same for you also. What does your Christian life mean? What does it mean that you're in a relationship with Jesus Christ? What does it mean that you're a follower of Jesus? Let's pray together. And let me give you just a moment to consider those questions. What does it mean for you to follow Jesus? And where would you put yourself when you're thinking about being one of the disciples or being Peter and interacting with Jesus? Take a moment to think about that. Consider that. Heavenly Father, for every single person in this room, whether the young or a little bit older, I pray that you would help them to consider deeply and seriously about their walk with you, about how they are in a relationship with you, and help them to really understand how you're calling them to a greater purpose in life, not just the regular routine of life. Not to be bogged down by things that are insignificant. So encourage them, Father, in their hearts, and make them uncomfortable in so many ways so that they would know that their lives are meaningful in this world and the next. God, would you bless us as we remember that we can be followers of Jesus to the very end, and he's with us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.